Hello and namaste. I'm Peter Furco, and this is Peter's podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. To start today, we're going to talk about mantra. If you subscribe on Patreon for Peter's podcast, one of the levels offers you a conversation with me and choosing a mantra. I choose a mantra for you to help tune you to deal with things that are challenges and to help you gain what you're trying to do in life to help you evolve and line up best with your karma. I did this recently with Jenny Bloom, and I thought you might be interested in hearing how that went for her. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Peter.
So I gave you a mantra. We talked about whether you should share the mantra, but I said that it's best to have a mantra that's tuned to an individual. So if you said
I'm not going to tell anyone.
Yeah, if you said what that mantra is, somebody might be tempted to use it, but it might not be the right thing for them. So right. Yeah.
And so, there's also something special about the transmission. We actually, right before we got on, I was talking to you about how I've learned how to not say everything that I'm thinking, and that's been a lot of growth, because I really like to make people laugh and I like to say whatever I want to say. But learning how to keep things quietly with myself has been really helpful, so I'm glad I can do that here.
Yeah.
And my experience with the mantra was really interesting. He gave it to me probably four to six weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I was going through kind of a challenging time. I do my own business, I teach yoga, and I have a couple of side jobs, and I live in New York City. And I have all the fun things that I do beyond the work part. So I was just in a super busy place. And I had one of my side jobs was working in this really loud, noisy bar. And I would have these moments at work where I just felt like I couldn't even breathe or I couldn't focus. And it was really hard. And then I would have to be there for 8 or 9 hours, which, if you know me at all, I never want to be anywhere for more than 3 hours. So it was really hard. And so you gave me a mantra and you said, when you're in that place where you feel you're losing that connection with yourself, yeah, whatever that looks like, overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. To do the mantra in my head, and I started to use it, and I was pretty clear that that job was just not for me, and that there was a lot that I have to bring that I wanted to bring, and that wasn't the right opportunity.
There was some kind of a block there.
Exactly. There was just some kind of a block, and I wasn't even sure why I was there. So in short order, that job went away in a very easeful way. And another business opportunity came up that I'm so much more fitting for, and where they really need my skills, and where I can actually be really helpful and do the things I like to do, and where the money is right, and where I can actually be focused on something as opposed to splitting my energy in all these different ways. And things moved very, very, very quickly. And I'm really grateful. I think the mantra really helped.
Yeah, and you know, it's not like a magic spell where mm-hmm. you say, oh, I really want mm-hmm. what that person has, so mm-hmm. I'm going to use this mantra and it's going to get it for me. But it helps you tune into what's right for you. Mm-hmm. And it was clear that what you were up to was not really for you, and there was something better for you. So this helped get that on track, right, to help align you with the right vibration of living.
Totally.
To make that happen. Yeah, and it happened on a few fronts for you, so that's that's exactly how
it's true.
It
there
should
were,
work.
There were a lot of other, besides the work thing, there are a number of aspects of my yoga, things that I wanted or that I saw for myself in yoga that really started to come together, more classes, some new students, some new connections with my teachers. And what I think is really profound about this, and what's profound about mantra, because it's hard. It was hard for me to really get my mind around, like, yeah, you should say the Sanskrit sentence in your head a number of times a day, and that will have an effect. Like, it's really, like, my rational mind was, like, not digging it or really believing it. But what's so powerful about the subtle and the vibrational fields and working with vibration and energy in this way is that you actually don't need to believe anything.
Right. Because it's simply, it's related to who we are. I was just reading from this physicist, Carlo Rovelli, in meditation class this morning, his description of his book. It's, first of all, it's called Reality Is Not What It Seems. But the description of what he says reality is nothing, basically. There's a lot of nothing, and then there's this vibration of energy and time and space that come together and create events. And by using mantra, we're simply participating in that creative moment that creates the events that we experience as our living. So when we use mantra, we're consciously impacting what's coming about.
I really like that. That's that two-word thing that you said, creative moment. We're part of a creative moment that isn't our own creating.
Right.
We haven't created the moment. It is a created moment.
Our small mind isn't creating the moment, but we're part of the whole mind that is creating everything. And so when we use mantra, we're tuning into that aspect of ourselves. And then we are creating the moment, right? Our little mind might say, oh no, I really wanted, you know, Joey to be my boyfriend. But the
bigger mind knows that Joey would be a terrible boyfriend.
A terrible match, right. And puts you in a new job where you're going to meet the right guy, right?
Yeah. So, powerful stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing that personal experience. And we'll talk soon. Namaste.
Namaste.
Today, Ishta Yogi Raj, polarity therapist, and the wife of me, Wendy Newton, and I invite you into our kitchen for our latest episode of Kitchen Conversations about all things yoga. Today, we're going to talk about love, the love that you're trying to find, the love that you already found, and what it all means, how to get it, how to do it. We hope you enjoy it. Namaste, Wendy.
Namaste.
How are you?
Good.
We had good cream of wheat for breakfast here at the yoga kitchen. Yeah, I liked it. Today we're going to talk about love. And I thought as a basis we could riff a little from this book by Peter Marchand. This book was brought to my attention by Irina Kotikova in a teacher training about, 7 years ago?
I was going to say 8.
Yeah. The book is called Yoga of the 9 Emotions, and it describes a yoga practice that's built around emotions. And I've always found this practice really fascinating because we are so embroiled in the realm of emotion all the time. I mean, it's part of the nature of being human. And this book describes the 9 emotions, which some of them we would consider good and some of them we would consider more challenging emotions: love, joy, wonder, courage, calmness, anger, sadness, fear, and disgust. And I think love is also something we're embroiled in as humans, and you know, many people have a challenge around that. So I thought we would look at it from this perspective of yoga. So the first thing, Shingara, is the Sanskrit name for what we think of as love. And I'm going to quote from the book here. Shingara means both love and beauty, or the aesthetic sentiment. We feel this about our dog, Micah, who's barking right now.
I was just going to say, I think I need to excuse myself to let her in.
Yeah.
Now everything's beautiful.
We're back.
So Shingara means both love and beauty, or the aesthetic sentiment. A romantic atmosphere and the sense of looking and feeling good enhance love and harmony. The admiration of beauty and the love for harmony are essentially the same. Whatever we love becomes beautiful in our eyes, and we naturally fall in love with whatever we find beautiful, visually or otherwise. What do you think about that? Love and beauty as having this interrelationship, or anything else?
Do you want to know the first thing that comes into my mind?
Absolutely. This is a love tip. Always agree with whatever your wife says.
Of course. I think the first thing that pops into my mind is the fact that I agree completely with the idea that we fall in love with those things that we think are beautiful, but I think that it can become confused in our culture with external beauty.
Yeah.
And so I think practices like this have to be very, if you're going to do a practice around something like this, then it has to be very explicitly not focusing completely on the external.
Right.
Because it goes right into this quest for perfection, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And in yoga, I'm pretty sure that if you go back far enough, this word perfection doesn't apply to the external, although we've interpreted it to apply to the external.
Right. And I think he pretty explicitly says that in the idea that what you love will be beautiful.
Will be beautiful too. Yeah. I'm just saying it kind of got it, like there's just this little wiggle in my mind because it's really easy to fall over the other side of that and to get involved in what is culturally decided as the beautiful thing.
Right.
I don't know. For some reason, I'm thinking about how I've always, when I was a kid, used to really like when things were unperfect. For instance, like if somebody had a crooked smile or a buck teeth or something that was sort of unusual, I always thought that that was really interesting, and that probably says something about me and my...
You're an East Coast elite.
That probably says exactly that. What do you think about it? What do you think about love and beauty?
I think it's totally the case, you know, that even just in the most simple, almost superficial way, we fall for things all the time. You know, we get a crush on something.
Yeah.
And then suddenly that thing seems like the most fantastic thing. And then down the road, we come to a place where we're past that crush and we look back and we go, what was I thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the love, the attraction, and even the desire, right, get you into this place where that object of the desire is everything. It's the thing that draws you. It's the water element.
Yes, water element. And I'm thinking about this, we've discussed in the past, however you want to call it, involution and evolution, and how the emotions, when we're coming into manifesting something, right, whether it's us as people or whether it's like an object or a business or anything that we're making, there's this place where we have to fall in love with it. We have to desire it or we don't do it. And so as part of practice, that's a really important thing to know. But it goes hand in hand with attachment then.
Right.
And so then to evolve beyond it, there's going to be a point where you have to let go of the thing that you love. And then you get into sadness and, you know, the opposite emotions arise. So for me, you have to see them in this polarity. You have to see the one as promoting the making of the thing and the other as promoting the growth from having made it.
Yeah. So let me pick up a little bit in Marchand's book. In this section in love, there's mastering love. And he says, to master Shingara, we must first of all realize that beauty is everywhere and is always there to be loved. beauty is the divine nature of everything. If we cannot see that all-pervading beauty, then some people and things become beautiful and lovable, while others seem not. The fine and divine sense within that understands and admires beauty must be used only in creation, not in evaluation. So we're talking about...
in creation, not in evaluation. Yeah,
and in the everything, there can be the love. So there's no attachment necessary to a particular object. That object is just an example of this thing that we carry with us, this ability to love, this ability to appreciate the beauty, and in Tantra we would say that the pervading thing, the oneness that is part of creation is in everything. And everything that we experience in as Tantrika, you could say, is a way back to that knowing, to mm-hmm. understanding that. So anything that you see as beautiful can be your way of seeing that beauty is, and we follow that beautiness, or to use the Sanskrit word, right? We follow that back to our wholeness. Go ahead.
So there's a little hiccup that I see here, which is that there's a potential to try to rise above it, right? And to go into this a little bit, I don't know what to call it, but, sort of abstract thinking place where we know that everything that, in yoga we're taught that everything is dependent on the eye of the observer. Right? So that one thing might appear beautiful to me and another thing might appear beautiful to you. And we could say that part of practice is to let ourselves see everything as beautiful, right? And to teach and practice knowing that this manifestation is sacred and that it, divine beauty and love is existent in all things. The problem for me arises is when we, as individuals, right, we're yoga practitioners, but we're also, individuals with our own karma and our own samskaras and our own perspective.
Exactly.
And so when we find ourselves not seeing something as beautiful, there's really a, when we're walking around in this bhakti beautiful haze of like everything is beautiful, well, then that works. But when we're in the challenging place of like, I fell in love with this thing and now I'm really sad because I have to let it go. And I'm really angry because I don't want to. And I'm bargaining my ass off trying to keep it. You know what I mean? And I'm just really not going to let it go. That part of the cycle is often seen as bad. But it's not bad. It's part of the practice. So the practice for me is more about dealing gracefully with those emotions that come up as you fall in love with something and, letting that desire be in balance, but also getting better and better at expressing the anger and expressing the emotions so that you can move through them gracefully
right. And
let go of the things so you can start a new cycle. And that, I think, gets a little bit lost
yeah. In
our culture because we're either like promoting this like emoting, mm-hmm. like get your anger out, or we're, kind of repressing. Mm-hmm. And feeling scared about expressing.
Right.
Boy, I'm like rhyming. This is weird.
Good slogans.
Yeah.
You'll see them on an Instagram meme soon.
Coming to a meme near you.
I think the way that you described that in the beginning, there was one practice which is mindfulness oriented, like I'm going to try to see everything and I'm going to see all the beauty and everything and love everything. That's like a mind. I'm going to try to mm-hmm. do that.
Right.
The other is from the meditative place, more like a Ishta Kriya place.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You get yourself to a perspective where your natural perspective is bigger. And then you start to notice that you start to see that when you see things. And
right.
I think that looks like I'm sad, but I see that my sadness is just based on X, right? I start to be able to parse that even though I'm still having the emotions. So it gives you some mm-hmm. perspective is the word yeah. I keep coming to, but it's like you see more clearly what's going on.
Yeah, because when you're in it, you don't have the perspective, right? When you've lost something or somebody,
in the moment of the emotional reaction,
you're not seeing it, and you're just in pain, and you're just sad or pissed or whatever, or afraid is a big one. That's the kind of the first one, like, I don't want to lose it, I'm afraid.
Right.
So, you know, the key there is to allow the emotion to happen. This is for me, because I have a lot of emotions that I didn't even know they were happening. This is probably one of my biggest challenges, is working with my own emotions. If I didn't know it was happening, it's dispersed throughout everything I see. It's coloring everything I see, and I didn't even know it, you know, and that's, I think, where we all start. And then through just doing your practice every day, you start to see, oh, there's this emotion that's coming up. What's that about? Right. And then once you see what it is, then you can go, okay, well, that's my emotion, and I'm doing that thing where I'm looking at it, but I'm not just looking at it. I'm saying, oh, that's how I'm seeing things. And now I'm going to do a sadhana around that. I'm going to take the only action I can. I'm going to work with that.
Right.
Right. And it's a process. And then eventually right. when you get that perspective, when you get to that place, you start to get a bigger perspective, because, you know, you can't help it.
Yeah. Let me say that just in a slightly shifted way, from a mm-hmm. slightly different angle. So you start to see yourself having that thing, and you start to distinguish what is your emotion and what is your pattern, and then that you're noticing that means there's a part of you that can notice all of that. Mm-hmm. So that's the one perspective from you. And then the thing, the object, you start to see, well, I'm having this emotion about this thing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Or this person,
right? That I'm in love with this person. And then you can start to see, well, wait, I'm giving this person this quality. I'm giving this person
Absolutely.
This power, this energy of love. And as long as I keep giving it to that person, I'm not seeing that I'm giving it. Right. So it's like, as you clear that up, you start to be able to move into that place where you see that, wait, the loving is something that is there. I'm just assigning it to that person now.
It's so interesting as you're talking. I'm really seeing it in terms of the gunas, right? There's the I'm loving you. That's the sort of rajasic. And then there's the object of the love, right? Mm-hmm. From my perspective, there's you. There's the object of my love, which is the receptive or tamasic part. And in between is the loving. And we forget to notice that part most of the time, right? It just becomes either about wanting to have the object or wanting to be the object.
Yeah.
And trying to attract love to us.
Right.
Right. And I always think of things...
See, I would think that's we always have this little bit of challenge
yeah.
around the gunas, but that wanting to be the love, the beloved,
mm-hmm.
to me seems like a tamasic position.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So rather than becoming sattvic, where you're simply in the lovingness, you're there trying to become lovable.
Exactly. But we're not disagreeing here at all.
Yeah.
It just...
Yeah, they're just two different points.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, there's always that. Rajas and tamas exist simultaneously in all things. Doesn't matter. We'll go through that another time. But the point being that sattvas goes back and forth, right? So sattvas is always the balancing act. Sattvas is always the thing that makes it possible to be graceful in that unbalanced world that we live in. If we can remember that it's about relationship, it's about the thing that goes back and forth between you and me, rather than me getting what I want or me not receiving what I don't want, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, to me, just really hard to see in most cases. And I kind of sometimes describe it as like a line. So if I'm going to love something, right, it's like I can walk up to this line and offer it. right? That's still rajasic. I'm still offering something, but I can't account for what the reaction is going to be. I have to stand and wait and see, right? And that puts me back into the relationship of the sattvas, right? So I can see what's happening between us once I've given something, mm-hmm. right? And that also keeps it on me. Like, instead of making you responsible for the thing that I'm going to get back, I just step right up to that line and can't cross it. And it's the same on the other side. If I'm wanting something, I can go right up to that line and ask for it, but I can't be responsible for what comes. I can't go over the line and get it and take it forcefully.
Right.
Right.
And I mean, this sounds like dating advice too. Right? I mean,
totally clearly. Is. Clearly. But nobody takes this advice. We're online going, I need this, I need this, I need this. Who's right. going to fulfill what I want?
Yeah. And I almost think like the medium doesn't matter. Like, it's not that the online is bad. It's the expectation and the what you're doing. I mean, many people have met people online and have really good relationships from
Absolutely.
That. It's more a matter of what are you anticipating when you go out there? And if you're in this place of I'm needy, please like me, that's you in awkward relationship with love itself, right? Love has, you have to have this appreciation of love, that you are love, that you can share love with someone else, that's a beautiful thing, to use the other side of that word from this yoga perspective, mm-hmm. that the love and the beauty is our nature. Here I am. Would mm-hmm. you like to meet me? Mm-hmm. And then we can go and see if we want to spend time together.
Yeah. But what do you do if you don't feel that way? What do you do?
Well, then you can still be the loved, not the person who can't find love or the person who isn't good enough to be loved.
Right. So I think you have to deal with whatever it is that you're dealing with in the moment. Like, for instance, I know so many, I mean, sorry for blanket statementing anything if I do that, but in my anecdotal experience of having friends and having clients and students and just generally speaking, people, and I'm going to say many, many women, but not exclusively women, feel they can't find a partner. They're looking for a partner. They're actively looking for a partner. And they just feel they can't find it for one reason or another. There's always, in my opinion, something that's driving that not finding, right? There's something, whether it's like, I don't feel this way or that way or the other way, I don't feel good enough, or I feel scared, or I feel, you know, have these experiences from the past that are dogging me, whatever it is. There's no connection being made between the thing that's underneath, that's lying underneath, that's mine and my pattern, my dysfunction, my feeling, and the fact that I'm not finding a partner. That, you know, it's always, to me, looks like people saying, I don't want that, I don't want that, I don't want that, I don't want that, I don't want that. And I'm thinking, whoa, hold on, pause up, pause. Like, how do you know? Right? There's...
Because your perception is being colored.
Your perception, you don't, you know, it's like I stop short of saying, I don't think you want this, because what do I know? But I can see that there's something blocking, and they don't see that. They see only the searching, mm-hmm. right? And so I feel like that line analogy is really important. Like, you have to walk up to the line and ask for it, and then be willing to receive back what you get. And really look at that rather than discard it out of hand.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like that story about the drowning people on the roof of the house in the flood.
Well, there was an interesting book out a little while ago, and I don't remember the author, but I'll look it up and put it in the show notes. But Brian Lehrer interviewed this woman twice, once because she wrote an article and once she turned it into a book. And it was about how to fall in love with anyone. Mm-hmm. And she came from a family where her own parents split up, and it you know, colored her feelings about loving relationships. And then she proceeded to become a researcher on the topic of it as a journalist, I think. Mm-hmm. And so her way, the answer that she gives to that question, how to fall in love with anyone, is if you get to know the person, you will fall in love with them. And so her method is to follow this set of questions that gets increasingly more intimate as you go. Not intimate sexually, but intimate in terms
more of more information,
your
more
feelings and
yeah.
your important, mm-hmm. what's important to you and things like that. So, and so she has some anecdotal evidence about it, you know, that people coming together to have this, end up with this profound affection for each other, you know, respect and all those things that you would hope would be part of a loving relationship, you know. And it's an interesting concept because it gets right to this exact same thing that this yoga book is talking about. There is this love and beauty in anything if you can
find it. If you will be open to it, yeah.
And that introduces yet another yoga concept, which is karma, because your karma may not be to be with this particular person. Even though you see their beauty, you may go, yeah, but I'm not supposed to be with that person.
Or it may be that you are supposed to be with them and you're ignoring the signals.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, if I could bring it to a personal place, and at the risk of kind of giving too much information here a little bit.
That's why we have editing.
Thank you very much. You, for me, were that person that came in at the right time, and I was ready to say, okay, right? Because... But, I mean, don't take this the wrong way. It wasn't because you were, like, the most special person in the world. It was because... of course, it was that I got karmically that this was probably going to happen, but I had spent so much time not finding the thing that I thought I wanted, and in fact, even rejecting things that might have been fine, people, not things.
Mm-hmm.
But I had gone through a couple of experiences right before I met you that let me say, oh my gosh, this is what I've been doing. It was when I was really studying yoga and got into polarity and was doing all sorts of inner work just on myself.
Right.
And right before I met you, I had finally gotten to the place where I was like, oh, it's me.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know if you remember, you probably do, but I was like, I'm okay. I'm good. I just decided I'm fine. Just me.
Right.
And then you came and you were like, hey, you. And I was like, I'm okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it took a minute for me to say, okay, wait, I this is a good thing. So it's inner work, not outer work.
Yes. And I think that is, we take a lot of external work.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're going to lose weight and we're going to go to the gym and we're going to do this and that to make ourselves more attractive but we are less inclined to say, okay, I'm going to find myself and then everything is going to fall into place.
Yeah. I'm just going to do my work.
Right.
I'm going to do my sadhana. I'm going to be okay with all of the imperfection that is me and my previous history and all of the stuff that I...
Wait, you have imperfections?
We won't go into those. But yes, as do we all.
As do we all, right? Everyone is... There's this whole thing, imposter syndrome or something, mm-hmm. that we all feel like we're not good enough and somebody's going to find out.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of being a good teacher and being a good space holder is allowing yourself to be vulnerable and knowing what stories will resonate with the issues that your space holdees are having,
mm-hmm.
right? You know? So, I mean, it's a really tricky kind of a thing, but I mean, I almost feel like the more that we can just be human and hold space for ourselves, meaning be okay with what's happening, with the understanding that there's something we can do, but there's also something that we have to allow.
Yeah.
Right? That's also yoga.
Sounds like politics, too.
Sounds, well, because...
It's life.
It's life. Exactly.
Yeah.
But we don't often...
But we expect our relationships to be this sort of Camelot kind of fairy tale.
Yeah, it's funny, right? I don't...
Even though Camelot was a weird love triangle story, but...
You'll have to
the fairy tale, I guess, aspect. Yeah. I don't want to play you random ads, but I also don't want to keep asking you to go to Patreon. So just go, patreon.com/Peter's Podcast. Subscribe at any level you like. Thanks a lot. Here's the rest of our interview. We've been talking a little bit about finding someone, but similar things go on when you have found someone and you are in the inevitable situation where being with someone in a loving relationship involves its own challenge. You know, one's guard lowers, right? There's nothing to prove or win. And suddenly, you know, psychologists will tell us we start acting out our things from childhood or relationships that we had previously that we now feel safe enough to re-examine, solve, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a reword.
It's like
for
you
that.
It comes up for review.
Resolve.
Yeah, resolve. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just had a whole conversation about this reword, R-E, in front of things.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's really important because the stuff that is painful and buried in the past has to come up. And that's whenever that review or resolve is involved, it's always about gaining new perspective on old wounds. And to me, you can only really do that in relationship. And that's kind of the basis for me of any real loving relationship is that you hold that with care, what you're saying, the stuff that's coming up.
Yeah.
That your partner hold up a mirror for you that is loving.
Right.
Right? That doesn't allow, that's not recriminating, that's not putting you back in your box. You know, if you can be sort of solid enough in your own self to receive your beloved's issues,
right?
Emotions, right. Really, is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Then those things can be reviewed in the new context.
And more likely than not, your role, this mirror holder's role, you are there because the opposite issue is probably your issue that you're trying to work
so
out.
So complicated, oh yeah. My gosh.
So there's the need for both parties to be able to express their sort of childlike thing and also be able to receive that from the other person without losing it because it triggers all your own things too. And here's where, again, having a practice that lets you resettle yourself, that lets you move to a bigger perspective, that lets you draw on what Al loves to call the unbound intelligence, right? This, like, you know, Sigmund Freud in the Beyond the Maya. You know, I mean, but it's like that. It's like life is designed. I'm going to get into trouble here with the conservatives, but life is designed.
I always get to that place.
Yeah. Somehow or other, let me say it in a more neutral way. Somehow or other, we all have this ability to get inspired with information that we shouldn't necessarily have access to and to bring that to bear on situations, our creativity, our insights, etc. So
that's a little bit of a cryptic way of saying that.
Yeah,
sweetie.
That's what I'm trying to do. So then we've got something to bring into the patterns that we have. So we don't just repeat the patterns of our ancestors. We are evolving and growing learning.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. And I've always been trying to find a way to say this that feels plausible, I guess is a good word, that, you know, especially when I'm teaching polarity, because it's a lot about relationships and it's about relating to other and self and space holding. It's very specific about in that teaching that there's this third thing that happens. This goes back to sattvas as the thing that occurs between, right? It's like there's the seer, the object seen, and then the seeing, the act of seeing, just that it's not really very tangible, right? So when we are in relationship, that thing that arises, right, that changes everything, that is the product neither of my will nor your will, but the thing that happens to create the transformation between us, right? That sattvic moment is the shift moment. It arises on its own. And for me, that can get misconstrued as, you know, giving up your will or, you know what I mean? Like there's this, it has this otherness quality, right? Because yeah. I was going to say
it's the divine.
Right. But it is the divine. It's the sattvic, what I would call the sattvic essence.
Yeah. It's that, right? That's the point of letting that other thing that I was cryptically saying come into the situation.
That's why I said it, because I don't think it has to be cryptic. I think it should be called out because it's the thing that we all miss.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, in yoga practice as described in the sutras, I'm just going to call this out. It's very specific. There's this big perspective. There's our ability to do something as sadhana or practice. And then there's what arises from that practice, which is beyond the will.
Yeah.
And it's a really hard concept for us Westerners.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very visible in relationship, because when you have a you and a me, there's a third entity that arises. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really hard to give up yourself to that entity and to let that be what it wants to be.
Yeah, and in keeping with the topic, that thing is love.
That thing is love, and it is beauty, and it is intelligence.
Yeah.
You know, beyond my, you know, own, and hopefully my own can contribute to it and yours too.
Right, your experiential knowing or memory.
Yeah.
Learning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wanted to read this one little other clip from here, from Peter Marchand's book. Fourth, if we can remain as mere spectators, not personally involved in what is happening, this is how to master things. So if we can remain as spectators, not personally involved in whatever is happening, and non-discriminating, then beauty and love can be enjoyed without measure. The person who loves everyone and everything is always in love. Whatever lovable person or thing goes away is automatically replaced by the next, which is equally lovable. That's like non-attachment to the nth degree.
That's to the nth degree. And for myself, I would probably say feels unattainable. I know that there's a certain headspace that I can get into from meditation that is that.
Well, let me just follow with his next sentence, because I think it puts it in a good perspective, because that seems so abstract, right? Couples should understand that attachment goes against the very nature of Sringara, this love, beauty. While we may very well and beautifully choose a personal, long-term, and faithful relationship, it's important to accept that other relationships of different kinds need to be allowed, so that let's in lovingness, in growth. So like from this base that you have with another person where you're learning this unconditional love, you are also in life still. You don't just stop. And I think a lot of people find that's how they're relationships end, that they're expecting once they meet someone, my life will be good now.
Hmm. There are two levels of discussion here, right? There's the in-process level, and then there's the kind of conceptual level. And it is reminding me, you know the story, I can't remember which god it is, I think it might be Rama. He wants to demonstrate something. I'm not remembering it exactly now, but he wants to demonstrate something, and so he goes and he inhabits the body of a pig.
Yeah, Indra.
It's Indra. Indra.
Indra,
yeah.
Yes.
And
the Lord of the Gods.
Lord of the Gods, yeah. So I think he was mad at a wife. I can't remember, but
he's trying to show, he's upset at the people in the world, how they never turned to their evolution. And he wants to go, I'm going to show you how it's done.
Well, but he goes in there, right? Exactly. And he gets involved in pig life. And he has a wife and kids, and he loves the mud, and he's like rooting around in the muck, and he loves it. And the other gods are up there going, hey, shouldn't he be back by now? Like, exactly. He went there to show them something, but he's not coming back.
Right.
And then they go down there and they basically like cut him open and say, hello.
Yeah.
And he comes out and,
right.
You know, so it just sort of shows the nature of the difficulty, right? You get in there and you forget what the heck you were doing.
Right.
And you kind of get all wrapped up in your desires and your stuff. And so it's kind of like, for me, you have to be able to be in it because that's the nature of it. And to say, I'm not going to be in it, usually ends up you're stuffing something somewhere away in a back closet, mm-hmm. and it's going to bite you in the ass later.
Well, and this is why we say we need a practice that's regular to keep you plugging into your divine nature.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you start to live from that place, and the things here and now start to resolve in a different way, and you can see it, right? Like, to go back to our meeting, it was very different, you know? Like, I realized, oh, I think I must have actually done some internal work here because this feels different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if nothing else, you can recognize that.
Yeah.
You know, you can recognize that something is resolving in the external world because of the work that you did in the internal world, not the other way around,
mm-hmm.
right? And if we keep reaching out for the thing, out, we never get to the thing that needs the work inside, or often we don't.
Yeah. I have nothing more to say.
Yeah.
Is that good?
Yeah, that's good.
Well, thanks, Wendy. I love you.
I love you too.
Namaste.
Namaste.
I hope you enjoyed our interview. One last request. Judge me, please. I'm thrilled at the number of people who are subscribing and listening to Peter's podcast. In today's digital marketplace, ratings help expand my audience. Will you please take a second and rate the podcast? You can do it by scrolling down from the Peter's podcast icon on your phone app, or check the show notes for more info. I'm teaching a meditation training with Alan Finger and Sarah Finger in December, and a 300-hour teacher training in January. I also teach regular asana and meditation classes there. See ishtayoga.com for details. Thank you so much for listening and for spreading the word. Namaste.